Now, walleye fishing in Wisconsin and what the future holds for cool water fish species. It is the morning show. Walleye is the iconic native fish species in our state. The Wisconsin Walleye Management Team, they work in partnership with the DNR, putting together the Walleye Management Plan. And they say walleye consistently rank as our state's favorite fish to catch and eat, and catch and release rates are low compared to other fish. Join in on your walleye catch, stocking, bag limits, 800-642-1234. Holly Emke is a research fish biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Midwest Climate Adaptation Science Center. That's an eight-state consortium that includes UW-Madison. Holly, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you recently wrapped up a five-year research project looking to boost walleye populations in McDermott Lake and in Iron County in northern Wisconsin. Tell us what you found in that project.
Absolutely. So that project, we focused on McDermott Lake, which is a small lake in Iron County in northern Wisconsin, about 80 acres. And our focus there was trying to do this kind of large scale experiment where we removed, over the course of 5 years, just under 300,000 bass and sunfishes, these warm water species, to see if we could open a window for walleye to increase their populations. The idea there being that over time, we've been seeing these trends where walleye are declining. They're a cool water species, while at the same time, these warm water species like bass and sunfishes have been increasing. And so there may be these new limits being put on walleye based on competition and predation from these warm water species. And so we wanted to see if by removing the warm water bass and sunfish, we could create a release for walleye and open a window for them to increase their population. Over the course of the 5 years, we found basically no change in the walleye population. So kind of indicating that those the competition and predation impacts of warm water bass and sunfish may be a bit too strong in these small warming lakes for walleye. But what we did see is was a really strong response in the yellow perch population, which is another kind of cool water close cousin to walleye. And so it kind of opened some opportunities when we think about managing fish populations in the future, given climate change.
That's what I wonder. With climate change, you know, walleye being one of the most important species here in Wisconsin, what do you and your colleagues think is happening to them because of climate change?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And there's not necessarily one specific thing we can point to that is associated with all of these walleye declines. And so what we're kind of figuring out is that it's likely a complex of a bunch of different things coming together. So walleye are this cool water species, and so they need a certain amount of cool water and cold water to live and survive, but they also have some other sensitivities where they prefer some low light conditions. So when water is a bit cloudier, that's what they prefer. With climate change, water in some places is also getting clearer.
Those invasives, the zebra mussels, I would imagine.
Yes, that impacts it, as well as kind of some other drivers in other portions of the state, resulting in exactly those clear water conditions. And so that comes together. And then in other places, these kind of conditions that are disadvantaging walleye are then favoring those warm water species like bass and sunfishes, creating these new interactions and increased competition, increased predation. And kind of all in all, really putting a lot of pressure on walleye. And so it's really variable. It depends kind of on the lake you're thinking about, as far as the effects that are happening. And so it's not uniform across the state. Unfortunately, we can't make super large generalizations, but we're trying to figure out exactly what those drivers are and where those are really impacting walleye.
Holly Emke with us, research fish biologist with the USGS Midwest Climate Adaptation Science Center, as we talk about how climate change is affecting walleye population and what you see as you go fishing for walleye. 800-642-1234 to join in. Holly, I wonder, how sensitive are walleye to the warming temperatures? Can even a small change in the water condition throw their reproductive cycle out of whack?
It's a great question and something, again, that we're kind of focusing and thinking about. Fish populations in general are very resilient. And so a small change over a long period of time isn't necessarily going to be super impactful. But what we're experiencing now with climate change are these kind of prolonged, extensive warming events where a general, an entire lake warms up really quickly over 10 years kind of thing. And so that completely shifts the dynamics of these systems to be in favor of warm water species. So for example, McDermott Lake, where we performed that whole lake experiment where we removed a bunch of the bass and sunfish about 15 years ago, that was a lake that had much lower abundances of bass and sunfishes and much better habitat for walleye, but has experienced a major increase in water temperature over the past 10 to 15 years, which has then completely shifted it in favor of those warm water species and also created really different dynamics throughout the lake, lots of increased plant growth and things like that. And so kind of all of these things come together to put a lot of extra pressure on walleye. And overall walleye, I think, when we're thinking about these changes in water temperature and the effect on walleye, it's going to be the interaction between the increased water temperature and all of those other things that really have that impact.
Here's another variable, stocking the lakes. You know, decades and centuries past, there's been a lot of stocking of walleye. What is the, you know, and fish then, of course, taking hold, begin reproducing. What is the impact there, you know, versus the natural reproducing that Mother Nature is happening in a lake versus, you know, stocking efforts today?
Yeah, that's a great question and something that as part of some evaluations I've worked on with some DNR, Wisconsin DNR partners, has really focused on evaluating the kind of efficacy and of stocking and how well that is working. And I know folks on the DNR side are really looking into that further. The general consensus at this point is that stocking is certainly supplementing a lot of those populations that are declining with natural reproduction. And so at this point with these declines, the first thing that we see with these declines is that natural reproduction and recruitment. So as a fish kind of a baby fish tries to make it into the adult fish population, that's kind of where that bottleneck is occurring. And so stocking is being used to supplement those baby fish populations, basically, that are not making it to the adult population.
So when you, I'm sorry, I just want to stop you there on that bottleneck, because if you look at the eggs and the spawning and the hatching, and then you've got these, young, naturally born young walleye, where is the breakdown occurring in the cycle of reproduction?
Absolutely. So that is exactly the situation that we have focused a lot of our attention on. So the bottleneck that we figured out is basically happening. So walleye are reproducing, they're able to pump out a bunch of eggs and put them in their spawning habitat. And then those eggs do hatch. We collect larval walleye, these tiny, tiny little walleye. But then when we try to catch them again in the fall, so walleye spawn in the spring, right after ice comes off the lake. Mm-hmm. When we try to then catch them in the fall to see if they've made it through that first summer and basically made it to be a large enough size to then survive the winter, that's when we're not seeing them. And so the bottleneck seems to be over that first summer, where they have to survive a lot of competition and predation from those warm water species potentially and all those other things going on, as well as the warming lake temperatures and different habitat conditions and stuff. So it's that bottleneck during that first summer of life during these really early life stages that seems to be really limiting these populations.
The complexities of the ecosystem. Research fish biologist Holly Emke explaining it to us. The U.S. Geological Survey's Midwest Climate Adaptation Science Center, our guide to walleye. Join in on what you wonder about the population or your favorite lake or river, what you've noticed as you fished walleye. 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show, back in a minute with Holly Emke here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about where the walleye have gone. A paper published this spring in the journal Fisheries Management and Ecology said climate change has been implicated in walleye declines by degrading habitat and shifting fish community composition toward warm water species dominance. Join in on what you've noticed as you troll for walleye. 800-642-1234. USGS research fish biologist Holly Emke is with us for about 9 more minutes. Holly, tribal members have their annual walleye spearing harvest around April as the ice comes off, protected by treaty rights. I'm wondering, what do the changing ecology for walleye mean for spearing and netting and feeding indigenous communities from the harvest?
Absolutely. That's a fantastic question. So walleye in Wisconsin are part of a multi-use fishery, as you describe, in that they not only support a super important recreational angling fishery, but they also support this very important cultural, tribal, and subsistence fishery. And so the declines in walleye are very concerning because not tribal members hold walleye and their walleye fishing locations specifically in a very important place. And so when we think about these shifting walleye fisheries, the location, walleye are not necessarily going to disappear completely from the state of Wisconsin with climate change. It's just that the location of these fisheries may shift, where certain lakes and certain rivers where they once thrive, they may no longer be suitable, which causes concern when we think about tribal fisheries, where they are certainly very place-based. And so that's something that we're thinking about and trying to figure out, is how can we best support and protect tribal fisheries that are much more focused on a specific location, basically. But at the same time, those fisheries have also been are certainly some of the more productive fisheries over time, because they have been better at naturally reproducing over time and kind of in these more reproductive lakes. And so it's kind of this situation we're trying to figure out is what are the drivers of bright fisheries, of these fisheries that are doing better than we would once expect, and how can we best conserve those?
We also saw the daily bag limit tweaks that changed this spring in a number of northern Wisconsin lakes. The new DNR regulations are really looking at allowing anglers to harvest adult walleye, and it looks like protecting the young walleye till they mature. How much do you think this will help?
I think any shift in management towards protecting walleye is great. And so I think as we try to figure out kind of these specific drivers of what is impacting walleye, it'll be important to evaluate how these changes really play out over the landscape. And so I think certain things will impact populations in one place potentially differently than others. And so it'll be interesting to keep an eye on how these regulations impact walleye populations.
You're also researching bright spots, as you call them, where walleye flourish, learning more about where they are doing well. What conditions are you noticing that in? And how can you help? What is coming up for you there?
Yeah, as you mentioned, we're trying to figure out which fisheries are doing better than we would potentially expect. So these bright fisheries. And so far, what we've kind of figured out from our course evaluation, we're going to be diving in a lot deeper here, is walleye, as I mentioned, are this cool water species. So certainly prefer this cool water habitat, whether that's a deeper lake or a lake with some kind of cool water habitat, usually in lakes that require some deep water, or some kind of riverine habitat. So if a lake also has some kind of input of a river and flowing water, walleye seem to do quite well there as well, or a river walleye habitat or river walleye population seem to do quite well as well. As I mentioned, walleye also have this light sensitivity. So populations where water isn't necessarily getting super clear really quickly, they also seem to do well there too. And at the same time, these types of populations are also sometimes associated with lower abundances of those other warm water species. And so they have less competition and predation and stuff like that from other fish species. And so really trying to figure out exactly where those bright fisheries are is kind of the research in the hopper.
I wonder, might a flowing river be more hospitable than a cool water lake for walleye?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the type of question we're thinking about and trying to evaluate, because exactly, walleye in many places only really, outside of Wisconsin, really only occupy rivers. And so they certainly thrive in these flowing rivers.
Talking with Holly Emke, who is a research fish biologist with the USGS Midwest Climate Adaptation Science Center, as we look at walleye conservation in Wisconsin. What is changing due to a warming climate? You can join in on what you've noticed about walleye and how it's been as you fish. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Holly, the walleye management plan for the state, that is an effort by a number of stakeholders. We've seen that there is a new one, a draft in the works, circulated for public comment last month. How important is like a guiding document like this as a roadmap for the future of how we should treat the population?
I think it's very important, and I think understanding how walleye may be impacted by drivers like climate change and incorporating that into a walleye management plan, like it has been done in the current draft, is fantastic. And so I think as Wisconsin DNR continues to work with many partners and figure out kind of what works best and think about what works best for walleye in the future, that is very important.
I would imagine too, you have to really collaborate as scientists across a lot of different agencies and different groups to really figure out who's doing what as you try to nurture the walleye population in our state. That's so important.
Absolutely. And I think in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest in general, especially with a fishery like the walleye fishery, that's a multi-use fishery, it requires a special kind of collaboration, because not only are we dealing with state management, so focused on Wisconsin DNR there, and then federal kind of research on my end, but then we also certainly work with the tribal agent management agencies as well, because this is a multi-use fishery.
As we close here, I'm just wondering if you have any advice for people who enjoy eating walleye, like myself, but I don't necessarily fish for it, but I really enjoy it, in recipes. What are your suggestions there as a consumer?
Oh, yeah, I think it's really hard to beat walleye as far as table fare. I personally think it's just fantastic as a fish fry with a little bit of lemon or tartar sauce, stuff like that. But yeah, fresh out of a lake or a river and then fried up is my ideal personal favorite recipe.
Well, Holly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Holly Emke is a research fish biologist with the USGS Midwest Climate Adaptation Science Center. Ahead this hour, our conversations with Wisconsin executives continue with the CEO of Schneider. That's a transportation and logistics company that's based in Green Bay. Join in on the trucking industry, on Wisconsin's role in moving freight cross-country. Join in on supply chain issues. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now to our C-suite conversations as we dig into the business climate in our state. Talk with leaders who have rooted their companies here. Schneider, headquartered in Green Bay, is our next stop. Launched during the Great Depression of the 1930s. When Al Schneider, he took a leap of faith, sold the family car to buy the first truck. According to its 2021 annual report, Schneider reported operating revenue north of $5.6 billion. Join in on trucking and logistics, 800-642-1234. Mark Rourke is CEO of Schneider, going on 35 years with the company. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning, Kate. Thank you for having us.
You might have caught wind of this, but there's been some supply chain issues over the past couple of years. Not to make light of it, but it is such a front and center issue for consumers. And you being in the thick of it in logistics and in trucking and intermodal, what has happened in our supply chain breakdowns in America?
Well, okay, you're certainly right. Supply chain criticality, I think, is so much more on the forefront, whether you're a company dealing with supply chain issues or, as you mentioned, the general public. And so it's been, in my 35 years, the most disruptive period, which I think is a condition of both just outsized demand at certain parts of this, and then certainly the constriction of supply to get it to market in a timely and efficient manner that I think we all just kind of took for granted, that things that we had such a terrific, and we do have such a terrific and efficient supply chain network in the United States and in North America in general, but it was really tested and still is in recovery as we sit here today.
Well, I still remember the images from November on the 60 Minutes episode, or as, the cargo ship gridlock, as far as the eye could see, those empty trucks waiting for payloads at the Port of Los Angeles, truckers blaming the terminals, pinning it on the shippers, the retailers, up in arms, shoppers wondering where the merchandise is. So what have you learned through the course of this breakdown?
And as you we were right in the thick of all of that. And what I think we've all learned to be is more creative. We have such a diverse network of modes in this country, but all of them were under various levels of stress, whether it was the intermodal network with moving on the train or whether it was the truck network trying to get product. And so much of our consumables come from exports into the country. So that put the pressure around the ports. And so all those combinations together just created the chaos that is just now starting to alleviate a bit and get back to some level sense of normalcy. But I still think it'll take the rest of this year at least for that to occur. And one of the challenges we have, even the equipment to help alleviate some of this backlog, is that we're having a difficult time because we have a supply chain issues getting new trucks, getting new trailers. And so that's why I think we're in this for a little bit longer.
Yes, J.D. Power says this shortage in newly manufactured Class 8 semi-trucks is causing used trucks to sell for more money and with higher than average mileage. So how is the shortage of trucks and parts affecting your business?
Yeah, because of that delay, okay, we're holding our equipment a little longer than we would like. So it ages a bit more, has more mileage, which then means we have higher maintenance expense. And as you mentioned, it's also been a challenge, just like the equipment manufacturers trying to make new equipment with parts. We're trying to get repair parts as we're keeping our equipment a bit longer. And all of that is still very much a challenge. And it's a day-to-day combat, actually, just to try to make sure that we can keep the uptime on our fleet because of the lack of availability of replacement parts.
What about the impact of the global computer chip shortage? Is that impacting the trucking industry?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really put a cap on how many new trucks can be built, not only last year, but this year. And we expect that to still continue well into next year. So it's not as if this is an immediate fix. And we've been told by our suppliers that we have a good while to go yet before that resolves itself. You're seeing it on the automobile front as well. Same type of issue happening on the Class 8s.
Well, before we put the lid on logistics here, I just want to ask you this basic question about efficiency. Are your trucks reaching their maximum payloads?
Well, from a fill standpoint, pretty much. We either weigh out, which we have limits to how much weight we can put in because of the bridge and road laws, or we cube out because it might be lighter weight product. And so from that standpoint, the efficiency factor is quite high and has been quite high. The issue is we've had more demand or more demand for our services and we've had trucks and trailers to fill it.
You've been in the industry so long, been with Schneider so long. Have you seen it like this before?
Well, we have seen certainly economic cycles that have a peak demand period, maybe followed by a less demand. But I've never seen a condition that remotely resembles what we've been through the last 24 months, which is squeezed on both the supply and demand side. And a lot of reasons for that, a lot of stimulus, a lot of change in consumer behavior, but all it was almost the perfect storm. And so the length and the depth of this has just been unprecedented.
We're talking with businesses all over Wisconsin this summer and looking at the freight industry now with Mark Rourke, CEO of Green Bay-based Schneider. You can join in about trucking, logistics, things that are on your mind about being a truck driver, 800-642-1234. Mark, let's talk labor and the labor shortage hitting so many industries, not to mention truck driving, which has had a shortage for decades now. How is it today?
Well, one of the real benefits, if there is a silver lining of all this, Kate, is it's really shined a light on the essential nature and the noble profession that the professional driver fills for this country. And so, the recognition of how important, whether you're a shop technician, a professional driver, all of that has been raised in profile, which is really good. But it's still very difficult, as from available labor standpoint. There's been a lot of work on adjusting wages, a lot of work to adjust schedules to be more friendly to what people like to have from a schedule standpoint, when they're home, when they're working, the life balance that all of us have gotten much better at in this industry to help attract more people into the industry. And we've found ways through the school networks to both starting with our academies, but also with the schools that we work with to create more opportunity, bring new people into this industry. It's a great, noble profession, pays well, good benefits. And this whole spotlight is helped bring more light to that, which I think has been one of the few positives that we've been through.
Yeah, looking at your recruitment materials, saying drivers earn up to $107,000 annually, and sometimes people hear that and say, yeah, well, you'll never be home to see your family or never see your kids. That number isn't realistic. Is that top-end salary that you advertise there just trying to lure people in, or is that a realistic salary expectation that drivers can achieve?
Well, I think that one of the nice developments within the industry is that there is such a broad spectrum of opportunities and work configurations that can really meet what people are looking for. So if you happen to know and you want to be a team driver and see the whole country and not be home as often, those are the highest paying positions because of the work and the configuration. We also have lots of other positions where There's daily time at home or multiple times during the week. And so what is the individual desire and what fits for you and where you are in your life at this point? There's a lot of options that can be configured to meet those varying needs. So there's really not a one size fits all in the industry at all.
But you would say, though, a six-figure salary is realistic, that it can be achieved.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have a numerous ways for that to happen. And certainly you got to have some experience and knowledge and you got to build your skills. But the pay, the work, and the opportunity to see the country is very attractive to a lot of folks.
Well, let's take a call now. Brian in DeForest, you're on with Mark Rourke, the CEO of Schneider. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I work in purchasing, and I've been dealing with, forwarders or shipping companies and stuff across the world. But I just want to understand why they can get away with raising their costs by, hundreds of percent because of, everything that's happening.
Brian, thank you. Mark, could you make that out? I know Brian was dropping off there a little bit.
Yeah, I believe Brian was expressing some frustration with the inflationary impacts that occurred across the supply chain. And I don't know if he was referencing ocean or import or what he was mentioning, but certainly across the entire supply chain, there's been a great deal of inflation. We haven't even talked fuel yet. Diesel prices, as we've talked here about wage inflation, very much needed to attract new workers into the industry. And so I feel the frustration, and it's real because of the inflationary impacts that all of us serving our customers have felt.
So you have to pass some of those inflationary costs on. I mean, Brian is really seeing a rise in the cost.
Yeah, absolutely. Our cost, not only on whether it's new equipment, whether it's over-the-road repairs, whether it's the wages, whether it's fuel, whether it's insurance, all of those have been through a very heightened period of inflation, and those get reflected in the transportation rates. There's no doubt about it.
So on fuel, do you buy bulk fuel or, well in advance, or do your truckers, fuel up on the road? How does that go?
Yeah, we do most of our fueling over the road. We do have some bulk terminal fuels that we do at our facilities, but, our factories, quote unquote factories, are moving around the country. And so as such, we are fueling and certainly try to leverage our spend and with the providers that really take great care of our drivers when they're at their facilities. But most everything we do is fueled over the road.
Mark Rourke with us, CEO of Green Bay-based Schneider, operating in the North American shipping, transportation, and logistics space. Join in, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Mark Rourke's our CEO series here on the Ideas Network. We're in conversation with Wisconsin executives on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Schneider CEO Mark Rourke leading the freight trucking company in Green Bay, over 80 years old. We've been talking about recruiting drivers, about the inflationary pressures, taking your calls as well in the state of trucking in Wisconsin and America, 800-642-1234. Mark with us for about 9 more minutes. Mark, I just want to make a timeout here as we, talk about trucking. What could Wisconsin do to improve the business climate in our state, to make it more hospitable for businesses to get established here and to stay here for, like, as long as Schneider has been, 87 years?
Yeah, it's amazing to think that we've been in Northeast Wisconsin here for 87 years and the changes that have gone on, not only in the industry, but across the company to do that. I would give Wisconsin pretty good high marks for a business-friendly environment. We have good infrastructure. There's a lot of infrastructure discussion going on across the country with the passing of the infrastructure bill. And so that there's a lot of more focus in our world about where we could see improvement in infrastructure outside the location of Wisconsin. So we have a very talented workforce. We could always use more people and attract more people into the area, particularly tech, as our industry continues to evolve and be more digital. The specialty areas of engineering and technologists is an area that we need to continue to attract more into our state and more into our area. And because we have such a great work environment and home environment here in the state, we got to sell our story a bit stronger. We can certainly use those type of folks.
Well, I imagine you also have these relationships that you've built up over the decades with the local community colleges, local tech schools. Are there openings there for collaboration on the engineering front?
Yeah, we have our local schools have really listened to the business community well and are making some, and you hit on a really important one there, engineering and the business schools. So we feel really, really good about that progress. We're a significant employer of graduates from the University of Wisconsin system, the St. Norbert's College system, and NWTC. And we're really pleased and think we obviously have a great value proposition to keep people that can stay and thrive right here in Northeast Wisconsin.
Well, as we talk about young people, this is pertaining to very young people. The Biden administration, through the infrastructure law, rolling out this apprentice program so that 18-year-olds to 20-year-olds or so can take jobs as long-haul truckers. How do you feel about this program?
That program would allow 18 to 21-year-olds to cross state lines and interstate commerce, which today that is restricted at those age bands to just interstate. So that's an area, particularly in our industry, which we don't have because of the 21 minimum age requirement. We don't have a great apprenticeship program to take somebody right out of high school and build their skills into a truck driver. And so that's I think it's a positive development in some respects. The secondary consideration there is obviously this is a very safety sensitive industry, and how insurance companies feel about that age demographic. We're still in the discovery phase, but we're encouraged that it's at least being piloted so that data can drive decision-making going forward.
When you look at safety over the road, what can be done there to make improvements? I mean, I know that Schneider has been so focused on safety, but where is there room to grow there?
Well, it's really a partnership between the commercial end of the industry, but also the motoring public and the respect that they need to have around big rigs and commercial vehicles. And what's really encouraging, obviously, is as we're on this path to autonomous vehicles, that'll take us a while to get there. But along that path is a number of developments that add a series of safety and active safety features onto the commercial equipment. So, you know, adaptive cruise, collision mitigation systems, cameras for mirrors, and things that are eliminating blind spots. So there's a number of automatic transmissions so that we're not task saturated within the cab and focused on the road. So this the technology advancements, particularly in the last 5 or 6 years, have never been more focused on safety from the equipment standpoint to be an assist to the driver. Then obviously we have a great obligation on our training and our processes to make sure that we're doing everything we can to keep our people safe, but the motoring public. But I would encourage the motoring public to have a lot of respect and courtesy around a big truck.
How close are we to driverless semis, driverless trucks?
Well, the technology is advancing. A lot of things have to be worked out, particularly around the edge cases. And so I think you'll see some testing over the next 24 months in certain geographies where the weather is good, the road terrains are well mapped out, and you'll start to see some experimentation with folks outside the cab. I think we're going to need professional drivers for a very long time. I think there's a ultimately a combination that maybe some of the more unattractive elements of the route could be done by an autonomous vehicle, and perhaps the city work and the local work can be done by a professional driver around the motoring public. So I think there'll be developments of this model and adaptations on the combination between technology and people that I think could be both be good for everybody.
Talking about the future of the freight industry with Mark Rourke, CEO of Green Bay-based Schneider. Chuck in Sturgeon Bay is with us. Chuck, hi. What is your question?
Hi, this is for Mr. Schneider, and I'm not familiar with his company per se, but I recently watched a John Oliver episode of his show, and he covered the trucking industry, and I was wondering if Mr. Schneider saw it and how he responded or how he would respond to the program. It was kind of a scathing program, talking about working conditions, hours on the road, salaries, having to pay rent for parking their rigs on the company's parking lots, that sort of thing.
Chuck, thank you. Mark, can you speak to that?
Oh, sorry, I didn't see that piece.
That's okay. Yes.
Difficult to comment.
Sure, I understand. But I think it also is driving at, as you see how workers are treated. I mean, we've seen unionization efforts really sweeping across our country, the likes of Starbucks and stores and Amazon and Apple store workers. I know Schneider is non-union, but what are your thoughts on organizing and worker rights?
We have a great deal of focus on the experience of our associate base and what they get experienced, not only by interacting with our company, but the freight and the choices that we make on the type of companies that we interact with a great deal of mind share towards their experience that they're going to feel. And so our whole effort is to make sure that we have people that want to be here for a very, very long time. And to do that, you have to have a great value proposition and a great exchange, because people have choice to the profession that they work in and the companies that they choose to play. So we have to compete aggressively on the entire environment that we have here at Schneider, and one that I'm actually very, very proud of. And I think that's one of the secrets to our success of being around 87 years is our alignment with our and engagement with our associate base. And and on my watch, that's not going to change.
Mark, thank you for joining us.
Great. Thank you, Kate.
Mark Rourke is CEO of Schneider. It's a Green Bay-based trucking and logistics corporation. This summer, we're setting up a series of conversations with leaders from Wisconsin's largest employers. You can find these programs at WPR.org/mornings. And why don't you connect with me on LinkedIn for further conversation? I'm at Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.